Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. For those of you we haven't met before, I'm Ari Werthmann. I'm the Director of College Counseling, and I'm joined by my awesome colleagues, Tiffany Fujioka and Catherine Jacobson, our Associate Directors. There are some other folks in the College Counseling Office who aren't here with us this evening. Sam Freesha, Mark Cranwinkle, who some of your students might know if they study French. He also teaches, and our colleague, Lisa Nelson. Before we get started, we're just wondering by a quick show of hands, how many of you have sophomore students? Freshman students. And for how many of you is this your first time, is this your oldest or the first time you'd be going through the college process when this one gets to us? Okay. Well, welcome. We started doing these coffees a couple of years ago, really just to get ahead and answer some of the questions, even though we realize that the process is often the distance for your students. We know there are many questions. We know there is lots of information that's floating around, some good information, often a lot of not so good information, and we'd rather that you're actually getting access to the right information and moving forward and using that to help your students over the next couple of years before they get to us. So what we thought we would do is, as you know, there are different themes to the various coffee talks, and we do record them. So if this is so riveting that afterwards you want to listen to it again, you'll be able to find on the website. And then certainly for families that couldn't make it this evening but did want to hear this, they'll be able to find this information on the website. So for the components of the application of this first coffee talk, we thought we would just talk you through a little bit of what are the various components, how are they interpreted, and then also what are some of the myths that our families and students, especially our students, often have about those components. Maybe actually talk a little bit about what the reality is in terms of how those various components actually are used or in some cases are not used in the college admission process. And we'll sort of stop periodically to sort of see after each component if you have questions. This will probably take us around 20, 25 minutes, and then we'd love to leave the rest of the coffee open to hear what questions you have, what things are on your minds, and if there are things in particular you were hoping we could tell you a little more about, we are certainly more than happy to do that. Any guesses? Your students hopefully have heard this before. What is the most important piece of the college application? Transcript. Thank you. We sometimes have to remind the students of this. There are often myths floating around that it's testing. Transcript is the most important piece, and they get two things from the transcript, their performance in the classroom and the level of difficulty or the rigor of their classes. Both are important. I wouldn't say that one trumps the other. They're looking, too, for a particular, I don't want to say particular story, they're looking to see the trend over time. They're almost trying, you can almost think of a college admission process a little bit as like a detective trying to put together a story of who your student is, what their interests are, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, where they've improved. And so one of the things we actually don't do at Lakeside, which is different from most schools, is we don't provide a grade point average or a GPA. On our transcripts, because we want colleges to be focusing specifically on what is the story, what are the courses that they have chosen to take, what is the trend in those courses. We don't want to be able to simplify. We don't want our students to be reduced simply to a number. And so sometimes our students will get a little obsessive about what is my GPA, and while our office in the junior year will provide them with an unofficial GPA, which is really an internal GPA to help them, and some of you who have older kids might know what this is, it helps them use data that our office has to sort of begin to assess their chances of admission at certain places, but that GPA never leaves Lakeside unless they share that with people or colleges, which we highly encourage them not to do. So they're looking at, obviously, their performance in the classroom. There are a choice of courses. In most years, the standard student would have five core subjects. So the core subjects being English, math, history, science, and a foreign language. We typically recommend that students in their freshman and sophomore year are doing all five core subject areas, usually in their junior year as well. We realize as students get to seniors, they become really excited about certain subjects and perhaps less excited about others. we would say in that case, let's say they really love English, they could double up in English and maybe not take history, or if they really love science, double up in science and perhaps not take language. But even in the senior year, we still recommend that students are taking 4 or 5 subject areas at minimum. Colleges are looking for both breadth and depth, but with an emphasis on the breadth. Again, to colleges, we are a great school, but this is college preparatory, for lack of a better phrase, and there isn't expectations that students are being exposed to a wide variety of disciplines and different types of thinking. So we really discourage our students from pigeonholing. Sometimes they're like, I love science and math, and I don't want to write any more papers, and so I just want to take math and science, and I'll take those darn English classes as well because I have to graduate from Lakeside. And we're going to say that's actually really not a good idea. One of the biggest questions, and I'm sure some of you have already thought of it or been wondering it, is how do honors and advanced classes play into the process? There's a proverbial question that not only parents and students ask us and will ask admission officers, but that college counselors will ask college admission deans and directors when they're with us. And that question is it better to get an A in a regular class or a B in an honors class? And the proverbial answer is we'd actually really like to see the A in the honors class, which doesn't really quite answer anyone's question. So I think we've all sort of stopped asking that question when we're at conferences. So of course, in the ideal world, students would be able to take, an honors class and get A's. Most of our students are not in a position to take all honors classes and get straight A's. And one of the places we see some of our students making poor choices where it backfires is, well, I have to take the most challenging classes available. So they get themselves in over their heads. And so while they might have honors designations on their transcripts, they also have grades that are significantly lower than what they're capable of earning. So while the college might see rigor, they're not seeing any evidence of academic achievement. And so it really is about finding that balance. In 90% of the cases, the courses that the advisor thinks is the best course selections for your student, in 90% of the cases, those are actually the best courses for their college application. Some of the mistakes we see students make sometimes is they're so eager to advance and advance really quickly. Maybe they advance fast in math. They either took a summer course to place out of a math course, or maybe they even took a placement test, which said they can go to a higher level course. And they're in math classes that, again, with maybe students a year or two ahead of them, yet their grades in those math classes are B minuses and Cs, where if they'd stayed on track with their classmates, they actually could have probably been a B plus, even an A student. So in that case, the rigor and the advanced coursework is awesome, but they don't have the academic achievement to pair that with to say that I can be really successful in that coursework. So one of the things that's really important, I think, for students to begin to do is to begin to realize their limitations. And I think that can be really hard in a place like Lakeside sometimes, where A, all of our students are very talented, and B, our ethos as a school is that everyone is equal. We try not to distinguish between students. We don't give awards for that reason. Yet all of our students are at different places and do have different capabilities. And that can be tough for students to begin to process at certain times that, if they see one student advancing really fast in math and they're like, well, if I just work harder, I can do that too. And sometimes yes, sometimes no. We encourage students to not rely too much on tutors. That usually backfires. So I'm not saying getting a tutor here and there, that can actually be a really wonderful thing. But sometimes we see students that have tutors in almost every one of their classes, often to sort of be successful in those honors classes or in those advanced classes. Not only are they typically unhappy, but that typically detracts from some other things like their extracurricular activities or their downtime. So they might have really advanced coursework, and they might have tutors to help them get those A's or those B pluses, yet everything else is being compromised because everything, all the energy is being put into the coursework and to really trying to get the grades that are as high as possible. And lastly, before I turn it over to Tiffany to talk a little bit about testing, I'd say the frustrating thing about college admissions, I think, for everyone, is there really is no formula or recipe. And we always joke if we had a formula recipe, we'd be really, 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 really rich by now. And so there is no one path for every student. We have students that get into the most selective schools in the nation and they've taken all honors, and we have students that have gotten to the most selective schools in the nation and they've taken some honors, but not every single one. So every student's path is different. What they're looking for is different. And so as you go through the upper school as parents and guardians, whether you're freshman parents or sophomore parents, to really rely on the advisor or to email us if you have questions. One of the things that tends to happen, which is not healthy, is if student X has their best friend who's doing something, they decide they need to do that too. So it's this interesting dynamic. You know, we really, as a school, we preach and we mean that everyone's a really unique individual snowflake, yet all of a sudden when the moment comes, they all try to be identical snowflakes. to really discourage the students from making decisions based on what they hear their classmates are doing, or also, well, I know three people doing this, so I should be doing that too. Because there's often a really good reason why your student isn't doing that. And of course, their advisor or our office is always happy to clarify. And so any questions about the transcript or anything before I turn it over to Tiffany to talk a little bit about testing?
Probably more general questions about the training for the past few years. What do you see, like, say, graduate students, they're being accepted college-wise, training more toward the Ivy League, more training toward the top 10, or training toward the UW, or local, international, East Coast, West Coast, any trainings?
Yep. I'm just going to repeat the question for the sake of the lovely microphone in front of me. And the question just was, have we noticed any trendings in terms of where our students are applying to college and enrolling in college, whether they're leaning out of state, in-state, Ivies, other institutions? Every class is different, which is the only way I can put it. And I know that sounds a little bit hokey, and I'm not trying to deflect your answer, but it's interesting every single year. Like, we just sat down as a team. College lists were due for our seniors on Monday, and we looked through where all of our students are applying early. And there are certain pools, for example, this year Columbia is really popular and Brown's really popular. Santa Clara is always really popular for us. But the pools this year at Columbia and Brown are much bigger than what they've been in prior years. We haven't dissected it closely enough yet for this class to say. But I would say every class is different. I would say one general trend, which has been happening for the past couple of years, our students, and this is not only at Lakeside but nationwide, students are much more STEM-focused than what they were 10 years ago. So I think those of us that have done college counseling, the three of us for a long time, remember a day when a student said to us, "I'm dying to do engineering." We were like, woohoo, because engineers were in high demand. And if a student was interested in engineering or in computer science or even certain STEM fields like physics or chemistry, colleges are, I don't want to use the term aggressively recruiting them, but they were very aware of those students in the college admission process because they needed to fill those seats in the class. Colleges have tenured faculty members in every single department, and it's the job of the admissions office to bring in students for those tenured faculty members to teach. And the tides have turned. Now we have a plethora of students that are really interested in computer science, in engineering, in physics, in chemistry. And those are fields in particular that colleges are not growing because it costs a lot more to educate your scientists than it does your humanities and social science students. Not only do STEM professors typically make more because colleges have to compete with industry to retain some of those professors, but also the equipment that is needed in engineering and in computer science and physics and chemistry costs more. So there's a much larger number of students that are applying to STEM fields, especially computer science and engineering, than what we've seen in the past. So our students that do have a really defined and very noticeable interest in things like English and the humanities, those students are now suddenly in high demand among colleges. And when we analyze our decisions every year, we can see that a tiny bit in the trending in terms of sometimes why some students are getting in and why some students aren't.
And we're also having all of the coffee talks this year are themed around a particular topic. So tonight's theme is about the components of the application, and our coffee talk in May is all about data and trends. So I've heard that some parents are like super into data, so that might be something
that
you enjoy being a part of.
Throughout the past graduate, which school did our graduate students go to, publish somewhere to look up?
Yes, a good question. The question was, is the list of where our graduates attend published anywhere? So every year our office compiles what's called a school profile. It is the document that goes with every single transcript that we send to colleges for students' applications. That's to help colleges identify the caliber of Lakeside. So you'll see a lot of standardized testing data on there. And one of the pieces of data that is on there is what we call a five-year matriculation list. So where our students have gone to college the past 5 years and exactly how many have enrolled at every single institution. And that's available on our website. So if you were to go to Lakeside and then to the college counseling portion of our website under academics, you will see something called, I think there's actually a bar, it says school profile, and you click on that, and it's in the second page in there.
Any other questions about the transcript? Or I would see, is it a transcript question or a general question?
General, about
Class selection.
Okay.
Of course, okay.
So many local schools offer AP and ID classes. So I think that one of them makes
So the question is, we don't offer any AP or IB classes, but despite that, A, what is the rationale behind that? And then B, despite our not offering that, do we encourage students to take any AP tests?
How does Tiffany do the testing section, which is going to lead right into
that? Actually, that's a great question. Yes. Actually, so why don't we actually use that as an opportunity to lead right into the testing section, because
yes.
I think that's actually a really good question.
And I'll make sure to address that. So. First things with testing, you guys are probably very familiar with the SAT. The bigger national competitor these days is actually the ACT. More students nationally are taking the ACT than the SAT, and we've seen a similar trend here at Lakeside, where far more students, and this is a big trend that has shifted within the last 5 years, where we have a lot more students who are doing the ACT, sometimes in addition to the SAT, and sometimes solely on its own. There's also another format of tests called the SAT subject tests. In the past, these were required often by highly selective schools. Over the years, more and more universities have dropped off this requirement. So now it's really just a handful, like literally a handful of schools that will require these exams. And we find that they're typically STEM schools. So places like Caltech, MIT, Carnegie Mellon. If you're applying to something like an engineering school within a larger university, it's likely that you'll need subject-specific tests in either physics and chemistry as well as math. So that's a good thing to be aware of, but know that it's not going to be required for every school. And there are some wonderful websites online that track college policies around testing that you can go ahead and Google if you want to stay up to date. It's really what we use internally in our own office.
And actually, I think we have it on our resources page.
Oh, that's excellent.
Are you talking about the Compass?
Yes. So it's on our resources page if you are interested in seeing that. And then AP tests are another exam that's out there. Something that's really important to know is that no college in the United States requires AP tests for admission. So the only service that they have in the U.S. is to potentially give students credit in college. There are also a lot of colleges out there that do not award AP credit or that only award AP credit for scores of 5. And I think we have seen a lot of students here at Lakeside very enthusiastically sign up to take multiple AP tests, specifically in their junior year, and they get completely burnt out because that testing happens sort of sandwiched in between SAT testing, ACT testing, subject tests happening, as well as school. And students need to think very judiciously about which tests they actually really need to take. There's no necessity to take AP exams for admission to U.S. colleges. If you're looking at going to school abroad, specifically in the U.K., they are required. And so for those students, if you have a sense that your kid might be adventurous and want to have an international experience for college, then that would be something that's good to know. And by all means, I would encourage your student to consider some AP exams. There's very few that any students would ever take as freshmen or sophomores. And oftentimes, even if they might know the material at that point, they're not necessarily maturely ready to take the exam then. And so the vast majority of students will be taking those types of exams in in the junior year. And we have some classes here at Lakeside that directly prepare students for them, such as our math classes, you know, and calculus for sure. Language courses often are very strong preparatory courses as well. But because we're not an AP school, colleges aren't expecting to look at a Lakeside application and see AP scores. So again, students should think about this. I think it's very easy for parents and kids to get caught up in like, oh, here's another exam. Like, I want another gold star to show a college. But you need to really think about whether that's the best choice for your kid, given everything else that's going on. I did mention athletics, right? There's a lot of stuff happening. And studying for AP exams can be can take up a lot of time. All right. So other things, so when colleges are looking at testing and kids, when they're trying to determine, you know, if I'm admissible to a certain school, colleges will publish their middle 50% test ranges for the SAT and the ACT. And that can be a good signal to students whether they're sort of in the right pocket for that university. So colleges are looking to see scores that mirror or exceed that middle 50% range. Other areas, and we talked about the subject tests, really demonstrating proficiency for particular subjects within the STEM fields especially. And when the time comes, the fun part of all of this is that for every college, it kind of just depends. So you really need to make sure that you're looking specifically at each individual college's testing requirements to make sure that you're fulfilling the right tests for each specific school. When we talk about things that colleges might be wary of when it comes to testing, one of them is that they know, quite frankly, that testing is largely biased towards by income. And so the higher income, it's actually zip code is the strongest predictor of SAT and ACT performance. So colleges know this. It's not a secret at all. And so that is something that they're taking into consideration, really, when they're looking at test scores. They know that a lot of students here at Lakeside can afford test prep, and they probably assume that most of them do it, which would not be false. but just know that that's all being taken into consideration, that they know in a lot of ways our students are advantaged over kids at different schools. And the other thing is colleges are really wary of kids who overtest. And sometimes students want to start testing early. Please do not have your freshman or sophomore student take any official testing. I know I hear, for those of you who are freshman families, that there's quite a contingent of students who took the SAT as eighth graders. This is not okay. So no more testing. If that was one of your kids, don't do that anymore. Yes, we know about that because the scores get sent to Lakeside. So we know who all those students are. But we don't want frequent testing. Really, three times is the absolute max that any student should take any given exam. And so when colleges see, because often you have to submit your full testing profile to universities, colleges see that you've taken the test over and over and over again, that's a red flag for them. And they wonder, is this student or is this family ever going to be okay with who they are? Are they always going to be on this endless quest for perfection? Is that really someone I want to bring into my student body? So be wary of overtesting. That is my strong warning. some other myths that come up around testing, I think a lot of people assume that it's sort of the golden ticket, that it is the most important thing, or that it can compensate for lower grades. And I think at less selective schools, this might be the case, where testing can really demonstrate proficiency, even if the grades here at Lakeside aren't as strong. For highly selective institutions, it doesn't matter if you have a 36, if you have all Bs. They won't care. That's not enough for them. They want to see that you can get it done in the classroom. We hear a lot of things from families like, oh, but he has a 36. And that's great, and we're really proud of that achievement, but you still need to recalibrate the colleges that you're considering. Also, one thing to note is that colleges have zero preference over which tests you take. So it should be really based on the student. Last night, sent out an email about signing up for the mock ACT. And so for those of you who are sophomore parents, highly recommend that you sign your student up for this. It's a great opportunity for them to sample what the ACT is like I also recommend that you have them do it again in the junior year. And the reason is because I think our students are more accustomed to PSAT-style testing and wording of questions. And a lot of students just naturally assume, well, the SAT is a better test for me because they don't do as well on that mock ACT. The pace is really fast, and it's a different style of test. So I had so many seniors this year automatically choose the SAT because they just looked at the score. They didn't necessarily think, oh, how did I feel when I was taking the test? Did the questions seem clearer to me? But they said, I did better on my PSAT than my mock ACT, so I'm just going to go and take the SAT. And they took it a couple times and didn't really see any movement or any performance that resembled what they were truly capable of. And I said, why don't we just try, just humor me, just try the ACT. And every single case, the student highly outperformed what they did on the SAT. So I strongly encourage you to have them take that mock both years. It's no cost to you whatsoever, and it gives the students some practice with that kind of format. Oh, and the last thing is that I think there's a stigma out there. So there are a number of test optional schools or test flexible schools in the U.S., and that means that either they don't require the SAT or ACT at all as part of the admissions process, or they let students submit a kind of different combination of scores. So it might be submit a subject test score here and submit an AP score, or submit a few pieces of work that you've done for your class. So it could be some graded papers with comments on them. So just know that there's more than one kind of opportunity out there, and that just because a school is test optional or test flexible doesn't mean that it is less than or inferior in any way. And I think there's a stigma out there that, if they don't require the SAT, then they can't be a good school. And that's absolutely not true.
I was going to add one thing to SAT subject tests. A lot of you have sophomores who are probably in physics, some of them in honors physics. And I think the school doesn't definitively prepare anybody for the tests. But the theory would be, if you've had a whole year of Lakeside honors physics and you're interested in the field and you might look ahead to a STEM-focused application list, that might be a test that you want to have as a possibility. So I think sooner, not later, in terms of kind of content overlap is the way I would put it, with the books that are available. So I like, you're all here and you think I want to have a to-do. What you could do is you could buy the SAT 2 subject test in physics workbook, and you could have it at your house, and your student could have it in their room or in the kitchen or whatever. And you can match up some of the topics that are covered at school with the way they're covered in the book. And it becomes an extra resource to kind of track that material. It's early in the year, and there'll be a couple of areas in the book that we don't cover in class. And if they're interested, and this becomes kind of its own indicator about, they may in fact want to on a Saturday morning actually read through that extra chapter because they really think it's interesting and they really like this, or they saw it on TV and now there's a book that explains it and they enjoy the problems. So you sort of give them the opportunity to grow their own curiosity in the field and prepare for the test, which would come nicely at the time of the final exam in June. It's an hour long and they can sign up for that. Subject tests are score choice, so you will not be required to submit that to your colleges. So you could take it as a sort of opportunity to see. If your child's in regular physics and they love it and they're getting A's and they're just pretty juiced up about it, I'd also recommend you have the book and you can go ahead and have a crack at it. And if they're just in regular physics and they're getting a B plus and they're pretty happy, I would leave it alone and don't buy that book, generally. So I don't think everyone should run out and force this upon the children, but I think it's sort of silly to say this in April or May when you've all been here tonight in early November and we could do it now.
Right. And to add on to that, we had a number of, or I at least had a number of seniors this year who tried the chem subject test because they took honors chem last year, but that didn't turn out so well. And they ended up, even though they took honors physics, they didn't take the subject test after sophomore year. And they ended up doing it as seniors and kind of having to reteach themselves the material that they learned. And that's not how you want to be spending time your senior year or the summer before senior year. So definitely, if your kid is in honors physics right now and they're you know, at the end of the year they're getting an A, like, absolutely please have them sit down and just take that test, just so they have it in their back pocket in case they need it.
if you're wondering, on our resources page, and the sort of what we're referring to is if you go to the parents and guardians page of the Lakeside website, and you scroll down on the right, there'll be a place where you can expand. It says college counseling resources. There's an FAQ on testing there. And if you open that, in that document, it tells you which classes prepare students for which subject tests. So there will be some sophomores, for instance, who maybe took honors pre-calculus, and at the end of their sophomore year, they could take the math subject test, or the students in honors physics. It also has a document in there to the question about APs, which classes prepare students for which APs. Because we know a lot, one of the questions we get a lot is, how do we know when our student is ready to take a subject test, or how do we know when our student is ready to take an AP test? The vast majority of our students will take their first subject test and AP test in their junior year, and that's totally fine. But for our students who are advanced in things like honors physics, advanced in math, taking it the sophomore year, as Kaufman said, number one, it's low stakes. If they don't do well, they just won't report it to a college, and the college will never know they took it. And the other piece, too, is it begins to sort of spread out a little bit some of that work for them. I can't remember if you said this, Tiffany. The other little thing about the ACT, which some of our students really appreciate, all but six colleges in the country who require the SAT. If you require the SAT, or if the student submits the SAT, that's what I meant to say, they then, for the schools that then require two subject tests, if they submit the ACT, all but six schools in the country waive the SAT subject test requirement with that. So when you look at, for the schools that require SAT subject tests, if you look at the language of their requirement, it will typically say, we require the SAT and two subject tests or the ACT. So some of our students have found a great way to reduce the amount of testing that they have to take by being like, wow, I like this ACT thing, and if I take this ACT thing, then I don't have to deal with the subject tests, unless your student is applying to Caltech, MIT, Harvard, Yale.
Certain programs.
Yeah.
Certain programs. Carnegie Mellon. So there are a few exceptions there.
Berkeley and UCLA, I think. Engineering.
And just back to your question at the very beginning about the AP classes and the courses. So two things. Number one, when your students are juniors and you begin to visit college campuses, or for those of you that have older students and you've done the college visits already, one of the things you will hear, we hear this in families a lot, is when they talk up in the admission presentation about what they're looking for, you'll hear the language like, we want your students to take the most challenging classes available, like AP classes. And that's sort of a default in the sense of being able to articulate to families, because the vast majority of high schools offer IB, AP, ACE, there are a few other sort of conventions that are used. And so it's the easiest way to help families understand what they're referring to when they say that. But it's not that they're expecting it. So again, I referenced the school profile earlier on. If you look at the school profile on our website, there's we provide some descriptions for colleges to begin to understand what the sequencing is. And then in our recommendations, which I'll talk about in a second, we also do we dedicate a paragraph to explaining what the sequencing has been and where the student is really advanced. So if they're unclear, like, okay, what does this mean, this organic chemistry course or this advanced calc-based physics course, like, what is this? They're getting that both from the profile and from our recommendations. And the one other place I think APs have been really helpful, I got to sit in a couple on the Duke Admission Committee a couple years ago, and then recently on Hamilton College's Admissions Committee, and Tiffany can certainly speak about this. Tiffany worked at Penn for many years in the College Admissions Office. Was that when APs can help colleges understand the caliber of a school if they're not familiar with that school. So it was interesting. I remember one conversation in particular when I was sitting in at Duke where they had a young man who was really strong. He came from his high school, was basically a straight A student, had decent testing, but he was applying from a school in Texas they get very few applicants from. And so they were really pleased with all the AP classes, but sadly there are so many high schools in the country where those AP classes are highly watered down. And so the concern for Duke was, it's great, he has done everything he can, but does he really have the preparation to come here? And they asked the question, okay, does he have AP results? And so in that case, he actually did, and he had a number of fives, and that suggested to them that, A, he did have the preparation, D, this has got to be a pretty decent school. Luckily for us, we sort of have the reputation, our students and the caliber and our testing sort of speaks for itself, so I don't think we need that, but I definitely think for some schools that are less known among colleges, having those AP results can validate for the colleges that, okay, yes, we're seeing AP calculus on the transcript, and yes, they actually covered all the material in that AP class.
And I think the way it can, if it can help anyone at Lakeside, it's if you get a B in the class and you get a 5 on the exam, then that I think is reassuring to the college that, yes, you do actually like know your stuff. But again, that's not a thing that everybody should be doing.
Yes.
So like with academics and academic decision making, we want our students to take management over some of this we're not talking about testing, some of this testing as well. Are the faculty trained to work with those students who are doing well in a particular subject matter to talk to them about, for example, a subject matter SAT test? Are faculty working with students, working with advisors, working with you to give them signals so that the parent, we're not having to constantly
right.
micromanage our students' testing schedule, but they're
right.
doing it themselves with teaming with faculty and advisors?
My answer is yes and no. Yes, they're trained to probably answer specific questions about your student's experience. So any of the students can go to a teacher and say, I'm thinking about the French AP. What do you think to the French teacher? The teachers are not building testing programming into their curriculum, into their content, into their scheduling at all. And I would think as an office, we would say really, nor should they. You're getting emails from our office like about this coffee. And then if we direct you to the resource page, I would say that's something you maybe do with your student to say, let's look ahead. The invitation goes up for the mock ACT. So that's the start. And then you say, okay, we'll do that again in 11th grade and we'll do some decision making. And there'll be more of these opportunities for you to kind of hear. But I think the takeaways are you do want to be proactive with your student on this. That rather than do nothing and assume that an advisor is going to get in front of this and say, wow, you seem like you're really into history. Have you thought about taking a history exam, world history AP at the end of sophomore year? I don't think a teacher will do that.
Okay. So more specific to the point, they're not going to, so Owen, they're not, Owen's taking honors physics as a sophomore, because he's brilliant. they're not saying, Mr. Ratliff, stay after class today. I want to talk to you about the testing that's coming up for
they're not.
Subject matter.
Nope.
Because you're just knocking it out of the park in my class.
But we have tried to, as a result, to your point, because we've been concerned about that, last year what we did, and we intend to do it again this year, is we did it in January, February. In January, February, we emailed all the students that the parents copied in the honors physics section to let them know about this possibility. We also emailed all the students in the honors pre-calculus section to encourage them to think about taking the math test that June. So yes, we're trying to catch it because we want to make sure if there is information that you should know now, we want to push it to you so you're getting it. And then in the junior year, by the time they would start thinking about what subject test they take in May and June, they're already working with us. But we are going to push it to freshman and sophomore families. If you have a student who's really advanced in honors physics or honors pre-calculus, they'll get an email with you copied letting them know this is something they should think about during second semester.
You mentioned that there is some advantage in taking the subject tests in sophomore year, or?
The question is there an advantage taking subject tests in the sophomore year? Only if your student has the preparation for it. So the advantage can be, let's say you have a student that's in honors physics, or maybe they're really advanced in math and they're in honors pre-calculus. If they take it in the sophomore year and they do well on it, it might mean they're done with their subject tests and they don't have to take any in the busy junior year. That's one thing fewer on their plate. But they shouldn't feel, and I think sometimes students feel like if they're, as I was talking about earlier, that I have three friends that are taking subject tests in the sophomore year, I should do it too, even though I'm not in any of the courses for it, and I'm really an emotional wreck about it. And then that actually backfires on them because they don't do well on it, and it totally psychs them out. They're like, I'm a horrible tester. I'm never going to college. Like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And so that's where if they're ready for it, then absolutely. But they're not at a disadvantage if they wait to the junior year to do it.
So for a student in advanced math and honor physics, the student should do it when the school year is over?
Correct. They should take the subject test. We would recommend May or June. So as Catherine was talking about, sort of matching it up with the coursework. So when it's at the end of the course, so when they will have covered all the material in the course.
Or the subject test in French. Do you have a preference? I will say, repeating the question, if you were choosing between the SAT 2 subject test in French versus the AP in French, this is a little bit of a nuanced question, I guess. If you submit you can self-report whatever you want on your application. If you officially submit test results to a university, SAT subject tests go to the admissions office. AP results go to the registrar and never to admissions. So they're actually not an admissions tool, as was explained earlier. SAT subject tests are an admissions tool. So if you're doing it as a kind of piece of an application for college, I would say the one-hour subject test is a better use of a Saturday morning rather than many hours, and you miss almost a half day of school in the spring to take the AP in French. That said, if you're a Francophile and it's really kind of your thing and you love it, it's a little bit like I would say do both. Just dive in. Go crazy. At that point, there's kind of no downside. But if you can only do one and it's for college, I would say then the SAT is going to give you a little more bang for your buck.
Yes. Good question, because Tiffany mentioned earlier that in most cases, the very selective STEM schools require the subject test in the STEM fields. So are the non-STEM subject tests and things like literature and language, are those important at all? And so the answer is yes. So for the schools that still require subject tests, you'll find places like the STEM schools, as Tiffany said, like places like MIT and Caltech and Harvey Mudd will very clearly say we want the Math 2 subject test, and then we want a subject test in either chemistry or physics. But for some of the other schools that either require them or recommend them, if the student is not a STEM student, they should then just be taking the two strongest tests they can, or the tests they do well in, and that could be literature, that could be language, there are history tests that does require a bit of studying for students on their own. One of the things, and I know there are a few of you I've talked to about this, that's really great. If you haven't met our new upper school director yet, Felicia Wilkes, she's awesome. But one of the things she is tackling this year, which is really great, we have strayed over the past couple of years in a well-meaning way from having courses that really prepare students entirely for the subject tests. Because the subject tests, some of them can be a lot of just basic memorization. It's not necessarily the best measure of how well our students can think, but nonetheless, we realize for many colleges, our students still need to take them and do well if they want to be competitive at many colleges. So Felicia has really started getting the department heads to work together to figure out how we can do both. And so we're hoping to have some better proposals in the spring for how, you know, maybe perhaps a student who really does want to take the physics test, even though our honors physics course doesn't cover everything, what types of support the school can provide them to making sure they're prepared for it, even though the course itself is not going to hasn't aligned itself 100% with the test. I'll just move on quickly to another component of the application, are recommendations, and there are typically three recommendations that come from the school. One is from the student's college counselor, so one of us or our colleagues who aren't up here. And that's often called the school report as well, and that's a very comprehensive letter, essentially giving an academic overview of the student and then also describing what has been their contributions and impact within the school community outside of the classroom and what are their personal qualities. And so while we write the letter and we certainly infuse it with our own positive impressions, we're drawing a lot upon all the comments you receive over the years from your students' teachers, from their advisors, and there are other internal documents we're using to really paint a very compelling picture of your student. And then there's two teachers of their choice that they ask, usually from the junior or senior year. One of the things, and those are academic recommendations, and so sometimes our students will say, I want to use Ms. Fujioka because she knows me so well. And I'm like, Can she speak really positively about your participation in the classroom and your creativity? No. I didn't do my homework in that class. I'm like, well, that's great. Miss Fujioka loves you, but you should not ask her for a teacher recommendation. So we get them to think a little bit about, you know, that's where the colleges are really, when we talk about what is the story behind the transcript and the grades they're seeing, where is the oomph there? Like, where is the creativity, the originality, the critical thinking, the synthesis? And so the teachers help bring that to light. We always have to remind students a little bit. Sometimes, I don't want to say our students take our teachers for granted, but sometimes it's not uncommon a student will request a recommendation from a teacher, and the teacher might come to us and say, I really want to write a glowing recommendation, but Katie hasn't done an ounce of work in my class this year. And so it's actually a good learning lesson for them about what it means to request that someone advocate on your behalf. And the other piece too is sometimes we have students that come to say, I got off to a slow start in high school. My grades aren't off the charts amazing at all. And so am I going to find a teacher to have a good recommendation? Our answer is absolutely yes, because our teacher write positives. But our second answer is, you now have the rest of this year and the beginning of your senior year to shine. So if you haven't been doing your homework, this is a great opportunity to start. If you haven't been participating in class, this is a great opportunity to start. Like, our teachers want to say glowing things, so give them glowing things to say. So that is another part of the application. And again, it's not anything you really need to worry about now. As long as your students are working hard and being engaged in their classes, when the time comes, they'll have great recommenders. One thing that a few myths that our students have about the recommendation process is that they need to have one STEM recommendation and one non-STEM recommendation. It's like, they want to make sure that colleges see every side of me. There are two or three colleges in the country that specify from which subjects they want recommenders, and that's MIT and Caltech. We'll both say we want one humanities recommender and one STEM recommender. The vast majority of colleges say choose your two strongest recommendations. Now, it's going to look a little weird if your child's like, I really want to be an engineer, and they submit an English and history recommendation. That's a little odd. The pieces of the puzzle need to line up. The story needs to come together. But if your student is a really talented English student or history student and the STEM fields are not their strength, they should be getting two recommendations from English and history teachers. Or on the flip side, if the student is a really talented STEM student and their strengths are not in English and history, unless they're applying to MIT and Caltech, they should be getting two really great recommendations from STEM teachers. The other myth is that if we send tons of recommendations from tons of people who have known us since we came out of the womb, that will really enrich our college application. And as Tiffany can tell you from her time at Penn, there is a saying that the thicker the file, the thicker the student. I worked at admissions many years ago when we still had paper applications. But, you know, when you used to have those, when you used to carry them home, and I worked for Haverford College, and I took the train to and from work, and when I had those students that had a file this thick, I really was like, I hate this kid already before I've opened their file, because you are making me lug your file home. And so it's very rare that students need a supplemental recommendation. One of the things we do as an office is we really encourage students, if they really feel like they have someone outside of their teachers in our office who knows them well, to have that person send us the letter. Because as I was saying, we write this very comprehensive, single-spaced, 0.5 margins. Like, sometimes I'm shrinking the font to really get it to one page. And we're looking for as much information. It's almost like writing a report. You know, how can we make the student sound as interesting and compelling as possible? So I'd say a lot of times the recommenders are often repeating, those outside recommenders repeating information that's already in our letter. But sometimes there's just a great line and I'm like, okay, but I actually really want to quote that. So by sending it to us, we can get some of that outstanding info in there without your student becoming that file that every admissions officer hates, because instead of being able to read the file in 15 minutes, they now have to spend half an hour on it. And I'd say the very last thing, sometimes students think, you know, the only teacher I should get a recommendation from is the teacher I got an A in. I'd say, like, students can often look at their comments and tell what the tone of the recommendation is going to be. So there are often students that have gotten, or classes in which a student's gotten a B or B+, but you can just tell from the comments, the teacher loves them. They're like, they're a class participant. They, you know, when no one else speaks up, they speak up. They ask the question that every day leaves the rest of their classmates stumped and everyone thinking about it. And those sometimes can be the B-plus students. Maybe they struggled on certain writing assignments as a result. But as I said before, the teachers really focus on bringing out the positives of students. We instruct them, and they know this well, to not be talking about students' negatives. So it's a different exercise from the comments that you get at home, where they're designed to give you and your student feedback on how to improve. This is designed to tell colleges, this is where the student has really shined at Lakeside. So sometimes those can be from the teachers that gave them a B or B+, where there was something really dynamic that they really contributed to that classroom.
And I think that's an area where parents can be helpful, because a lot of times, like, students, like, attach baggage to, like, every class that they're in, and sometimes they don't necessarily see how glowing the writing is, because they're more like, well, I like this person better, and they can get fixated on that. And I think you guys see a little bit more objectively what those comments are without the additional attachment to a particular teacher, and I think you can be a nice set of eyes and perspective when it's time for the kids to junior year to start thinking about who to ask for recs.
Any questions about recommendations? I'm going to turn it over to Catherine. I'm sorry.
I just was told that sometimes, for example, a student, for example, volunteer in governor's office or senator's office, this kind of big guy can write a recommendation later. It's very helpful to admission is true or not.
I have the best story for you on this.
Repeat the question.
Okay. It was, I think, if the student has had exposure to somebody that is important or has valuable currency associated with that name, is that kind of an endorsement helpful for the student? This is a true story. So I have a student, and Nari knows the one, where he had worked in a lab associated with the University of Washington, and he said, I would really like to get a person from the lab to talk about my work. And I said, I think that's a marvelous idea. Let's do that, and please send it to me, and here's my crazy spelling of Catherine, and make sure I get it. And he said he would. And the letter came, and it was fabulous, from the lab assistant. It described his habits in the lab, the stuff that he did really well, some of the conversations that they had, the richness of this experience, and just really how connected they had been. The parent, who is a scientist, heard about this and said, well, that's just about the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Why on earth would you have the lab assistant write? You need the person who runs the lab with the title. So the poor kid is like, oh my gosh. So he tells me, I've got another one coming. I forward this to Ari. Hold our horses. We've got to wait for another letter. I'm thinking now two people have had to go through this. I'm sort of actually finished incorporating the fabulous letter into mine. And you know what happens, right? The letter from the famous person comes. It's terrible. It is the most cursory 5-minute, I just pulled some stock phrases, here's another person wanting to borrow my name. I don't even know this kid. And luckily, it came to me, not to the college. So I wrote back to the student and I said, we're gonna say thank you very, very much to both people. We're gonna write handwritten notes, and then we're gonna use the first one because it helps you, and the second one is valueless. So the importance of the name is irrelevant. It is what they can add in terms of information about the student and who they are, and it really needs to be new information if it's anything.
Yep. I read lots of senator letters that had very just no substance.
Yeah, you had a question.
And the letters should come from high school teachers, right? Even if the student has stayed very close to some of the middle school teachers?
Correct. The question is, should they come from high school teachers? And absolutely. And with a few exceptions here and there, they should really come from junior and senior teachers in select circumstances. There are okay, in which, and again, these are, we will always talk with you and your students. There have been some really outstanding reasons and cases where a sophomore teacher has written a letter, and those are probably most often the cases where they had the teacher as a sophomore, and now they have them again at the beginning of their senior year. So that's always a possibility too.
So you mean actually the letters need to come from the junior and senior years, not even sophomore years, the advanced physics, or no?
The vast majority of letters are coming from junior year, a little bit more from senior year, and rarely they're coming from sophomore year, never from freshman year.
Okay.
Right? They're trying to get the closest assessment to who you're going
right.
to be when you're in college.
But
and that's,
don't take the, I mean, when they, as I understand it, when they're done with biology, they're done, right? They're not going to take biology again.
They might take it again as a senior. Advanced bio. But yes, we don't, right? Colleges, when they see a freshman teacher rec, they think, well, what happened during sophomore and junior year that you didn't have anybody to ask? So that's, yeah, that's how colleges interpret that.
I'm going to turn over to Catherine to talk a little bit briefly about activities.
So given that they have to, with early decision being made in your senior years, most of them applying, they may not have had enough time to actually meet very much with their senior teachers. So would you say that most of the recommendations do come during the junior?
Good question. And the question is, because with early decision, and if you don't know what that is, there are many, many colleges that offer early application programs where there are deadlines now in November, and they hear in mid-December. And so if they're applying under an early program, if they ask a senior year teacher, does the senior year teacher who maybe has never had them before really have the capacity to write well on their behalf? I would say the majority of our students are asking junior teachers, but a number do ask senior year teachers. And the great thing about teacher recs is it's not so much, I wouldn't think of the teacher recommendation as this is the summary of how the entire year went. It's more about what are the students' strengths. And so I can think of one young man, I was sort of actually briefly telling the story earlier, when he was sort of like, I've sort of only really kicked it into gear like spring of my junior year. And I sort of like was, you know, just kicking back and eating bonbons up until that point. He's been very open about that. And he was like, so what do I do for teacher recs? And so he did have one teacher in the junior year who he loved, and the teacher really loved him and did a great letter. But he's asking one of his senior teachers, and he's doing great in the class, and the teacher wrote him a glowing rec, because really, he's really engaged in the class. He participates every day. They've had a few tests. And it's not, if you're the student's engaged in the class, it's really not hard for a teacher over a period of even a month just to pull out what are they talented at, what is their potential, what are their strengths. Although we do tell the students, I was saying before, if you're going to ask a senior teacher, don't sit in that classroom for a month and be quiet and miss your homework and not do well on the test. That's a really bad recipe for getting a strong teacher recommender. I'm going to turn over to Catherine just because I want to be conscious of the time.
Good.
I'm sorry, what was
no,
the
two. So the counselor writes one letter, and then the students ask two academic teachers from junior and senior year, and those go directly to the college with ours. So three from Lakeside directly to the college. The thing that would go to us is something from outside. So if you worked in a lab, or you had a different, you know, an employer, or somebody at maybe a religious organization where you've done a lot of volunteering and you've been a parishioner for a long time, or I mean something along those lines. Those ones come to us. Teachers will only, I think, accept the responsibility if they feel really confident they can do a strong and, as Ari said, glowing job. They just, I think that's the culture of the school, and I think we would double check that with the kids. We talk to them about who they're picking and why, and yeah.
Students and families, or students, waive their rights to see, like, you don't have access to any of these letters. They're all confidential, so.
Okay, this is activities. So extracurriculars would be the theme that we're on right now. And I would like to just start with kind of a thematic overview, because I think the things that we've talked about so far do this kind of hierarchical, if that's the right way to say that word, evaluative idea that has this instinct in, I think, all of your minds as parents, and I am a parent of kids around this age, a little older, of kind of lining them up in order. And it's a little bit, am I kid number 16? Am I kid number 52? Am I kid 112? And, you know, because testing is a number and it goes in order. And how hard were my classes? And, you know, have I gotten A's or A minuses or B's and B pluses? And do I have this kind of a rec or that kind of a rec? Extracurriculars are not in this zone, and they get at really an important part of the process, which is selective colleges, the most selective ones in the country, do not put the children in order and pick the top 100 for their freshman class and then stop and then waitlist the next 20 and deny everybody else. You should imagine all of your children, because they go here and they're capable, great kids who are going to have all this support, to be put with all the other wonderful children in a place like Safeco Field. Seriously, in all, like literally. And imagine the admissions officers going in with their clipboards, shopping for students. And that is what they are doing. They are shopping for a freshman class. and they need all kinds of things in their market basket, okay? So this is really a place where this comes out. There's a part of the Common App that says there are 10 spots that you could fill up for your activities. You do not need to have all 10 filled up. Definitely not required. I think if you have less than 4, it can look a little bit thin, just if we wanted to kind of have a place that we said, you know, let's get to 5 or 6 generally, and I think most kids really will. So that's not a concern, but if that gives you a frame. You are asked to, as the student, to prioritize them. So number one, what they're doing is, who is this student? Kind of the detective work that Ari was talking about. What have they picked as their top thing? What have they put as the second thing? What have they put as third? And then it asks, how long have you been doing this? And how many hours a week do you do it? And how much of the year? And is it in the summer, et cetera? And a few little phrases that describe the activity. So what we're doing now is looking at evidence of commitment, consistency of participation, growth in it. Maybe I'm a captain, maybe I'm a starter, I was on JV, I moved to varsity, et cetera, et cetera. I got faster as a swimmer, I was on student government as a rep in 9th grade, I'm now vice president of the student body. Any of these things, I become a tattler, I've become an editor as I've moved along. And then the next thing, it becomes back to this shopping in Safeco Field moment. It's the past performance is a prediction of the future. We're really about, we're not giving out awards for who was the best high school student in the country. We're building a class about who's going to contribute on our campus and what does that look like. Who's going to take advantage of what we have? Who's going to participate, and what is that participation going to look like? So the kids are asked, do you intend to continue this in college? I say to the kids, really, in general, my theme is you want about 2/3 of these activities to be yes. Otherwise, why the heck were you doing them? Spending all this time, you're like, never going to do that again. That, I mean, a couple of things you'll drop off. You know, I was on student newspaper, I might not do that again, I didn't love it. But it's a bit odd if you think about it, right? To have activities that you say, I spent all this time and it's on my applications for college, but I have no intention of pursuing it. So that then becomes the threshold of how are your children spending their time. It should be stuff they're really passionate about. It should be stuff they want to do more of. It should be places that they're likely to want to continue. They should continue trying new stuff. This is, you're absolutely at the moment where they could join a new club, try a new sport, sign up for swimming if they haven't done it before, whatever that is. There's lots of chances for them to feel, especially, I know it's hard for freshmen, but especially the sophomores in the room, really talk with your student about what's available at school, ask what they're curious about, drop some stuff, add some new things. That's really important. Jobs go on there, so employment experience, that goes in that spot as well. It will ask for ways that you've contributed community service-wise, and a way I think about this is kind of the soccer player who is, you know, Mr. Soccer with cleats, and I'm on this, whatever that is, the Seattle Sounders, I'm almost a professional, plus I'm at Lakeside Varsity, and it's really all about me, and my family has no vacations because all we do is drive to tournaments. So do you coach small children in the sport, right? Do you do any fundraising that collects up old cleats and says, we've got organizations that could use cleats because our feet have grown and we play so much that we need new fancy ones and somebody else can use them? So there's deeper evidence within these strands, not just, well, as my husband says, there's givers and there's takers. Your child should not just be as an activity, I'm a taker. I take from the activities. It's, I'm committed to them as a concept all the way through. Okay. So, Tiffany made a really nice list, and I'll make sure I got it. They are wary of 2 things, inflated hours, so don't lie, because it's stupid. There's not so many hours in a week. You can't say you do go to school and travel in traffic in Seattle and do 9 hours a day of something. It won't be true. Disingenuous participation. I think I know what she means about this, but that's the, I did it for 4 years, and I do it 1 hour every 3 weeks, and I don't actually intend to continue in college, and I have no leadership, and it's like, well, what even is it? If I'm the counselor, I would actually just knock it off and say, now you have 7 activities, not 8. You know, you just erase. So that would be that one. There's no magic formula, and this is true, especially I wanted to tell the mother who wrote to me in all seriousness last summer and said, gosh, Catherine, I have figured it out. It's sailing. I've heard colleges love sailors. And I've signed her up for a sailing camp, and I want to know if we should continue this in the fall. And does she like sailing is really the only question. I mean, yeah. How's the weather? I don't know. There's no one thing. So don't try to figure that out. If you can't fill up every space, you're doomed. This is a myth. It's the quality of your commitment, as we talked about. And only certain things will count, and I think Tiffany has a nice list, stuff that I recommended before: sports, clubs, especially at school, student governments, volunteering, part-time jobs, taking care of elderly family members, younger siblings, those kinds of responsibilities at home are all part of it. Things that don't count: chores, emptying the dishwasher, etc. Family laundry, no. Feeding your cat, watching television, video games of any sort, computer games of any sort, and hanging out with friends. And I also have to put my own favorite that I don't allow is baking. It's just, it's fun. It's, there's sometimes there's little short answer questions on the applications where it's, what would you do if you had 3 hours of free time? Then you can say, I'd make a big pan of brownies with some friends. I mean, this is, that's a good answer for that, but yes, it's not an activity.
I okay. literally had someone write taking care of their cat on one of them.
Yeah.
So that does not count.
Well, I had the mother who said, I think it's all about sailing.
Yeah.
So.
All right. We're going to segue on to essays, just so that we can wrap up the main components and then open it up to bigger Q&A. So you guys will hear a lot more about this when your students are juniors, so I don't want to dwell on it too much, but I want to say a few things. One, they only have 500 to 650 words. They often think that it needs to be some super serious, like, deep, intense topic. Absolutely not. Oftentimes, the best essays are about very ordinary, everyday things. So if they feel tempted to think, oh, well, this is not serious enough, it's not intellectual enough, or whatever it is, just tell them to relax. This is the one piece of the application that students have 100% control over. And so I have, my whole career, have told students, you need to take advantage of that. Use that. This is your opportunity to tell them something about you that they don't already know from the other parts of the application. When colleges are reading essays, they're really just trying to get to know the kid. It's a lens into how the student thinks, what they value, what they care about. Obviously, they're going to care about the quality of writing. They also might be looking in other particular essays about how much the student understands the university. If a university asks them to respond to a question, you know, why do you want to come here? Tell me about your interest in our school. The student really needs to be able to articulate why they think they're a good fit for the school. When I worked for Penn, I used to tell kids, if you can't make a case for fit in your essay, it makes it hard for me to advocate you in admissions, for you in admissions committee. So when they hear it that way, then they pay attention a little bit more. The other thing that's really important is that the essay sounds authentic. What I mean by that is that it needs to sound like a student wrote it. And I know it can be super tempting as parents to want to get our hands in a student's essay. And I actually had one student this year who was like, oh, we had a bunch of like relatives in town, and they took a look at my essay, and they said, let me see it. I could tell exactly where the changes were made. The voice sounded extremely different. Formal language, the way kids, teenagers do not talk. And so I can pick up on that. I guarantee you every college can pick up on that. Admissions officers read a lot of these essays. They know when they have been doctored by someone other than the student. We have the teachers who talk about the quality of writing. We have the comments that we end up putting in our rec letters about the quality of writing. So there's things that a university can compare it against. And if something sounds fishy and that's a red flag, they're just going to move on to the next applicant. Because why waste their time on someone who doesn't seem like they're being genuine, or who's trying to come across as submitting someone else's work as their own? Just avoid that altogether. I think it's fine to be a voice, but do not have your hands too involved in your students' essays.
And I would say, before we open up to questions, just some of the takeaways, sort of summarizing everything we've heard. So what can your student be doing now? What can you be doing now? I would say, obviously, I think the most important thing, as I said earlier, most important piece of the application is the transcript. And so they should be putting their best foot forward, taking the classes that are right for them. Again, as I cautioned earlier, a tutor here and there is fine. They shouldn't be relying on tutors entirely. They also, I can't emphasize this enough, and I think one of the things that's really changed over the past 5 to 10 years, our students are reading less. They're reading less outside the classroom. A lot of times it's to make room for all types of extracurricular activities. And we want them to be involved in some extracurricular activities, but finding the balance and time to pleasure read, and I know that sounds hokey, but reading impacts their capacity to write, which is not only important for college, it's also important for their college application, as Tiffany was talking about. There is no better preparation for the SAT and the ACT critical reading sections than actual reading. There is no amount of tutoring and test prep that can compensate for a student that is not a reader. And so making sure that all the free time they have isn't used up, you know, as Catherine was saying, I know it's hard in this day and age, racing between the different select sports programs and doing tons of extracurriculars where the only reading that's occurring is the reading that happens in the classroom, and that even then sometimes we know that reading, they're relying on all different types of online resources to give them the summary of that reading and to tell them what they should know. So making sure that reading is a value, I would say, that the student is learning to really incorporate into their lives, I think is really, really important. And it could be what they like. Like, if they're a STEM kid, those science magazines, like, you know, what was it, Popular Science or something? I'm not a STEM person. I don't even know the difference between a molecule and a compound. But that is just, that's great reading. So it really can be things they like to read. They don't have to find fancy books that they really have no interest in ever reading. In terms of, you know, Catherine was talking about the activities, really helping them, you know, supporting them in finding the activities they really like and really care about and sticking with those, but also making sure there's a balance between their capacity to do structured activities and also have room for non-structured activities like baking and things they really enjoy. I remember a couple of years ago we had Stu Schmill, the Dean of Admission at MIT, here for our Deans and Directors panel that we have for junior parents and guardians. And on the MIT application, they have 5 short prompts. And the first one is, what does your student do for fun? And he said, you can't imagine, I remember this first thing, how many answers go something along the lines of, on Saturdays, I take such pleasure and joy in going down to the homeless shelter and serving soup to people in need. And he was like, we're glad they do that, and there's room in their lives for that. We hope they are committed to helping other people. But we know that's not what you're doing for fun. We know that is the answer you constructed because you think that's what we want to hear. We want to hear, like, do you bake, or do you go out with your friends and shoot hoops, or do you read in your free time? Like, so they it actually really backfires on them when everything is so structured that when they're asked what hobbies do you have or what free time do you have, that they can't name a single hobby or interest that wouldn't go on a resume. And so making sure there's that balance for them to find that, and also even to have that time to reflect on some of the activities Catherine was talking about. An outstanding, impressive resume is great, but when you have the question on the application, which about half the schools do, please talk about a meaningful extracurricular activity. It is sad for us. I don't want to say it's a lot of students, but there are a number of students that really can't respond to that because they've just gotten into the motion of being like a robot, of going from activity to activity to activity. And so again, that resume is awesome, but they can't bring that resume to life. Because there really isn't any meaning behind it. So making sure there's the balance to not only find things that are fun, but also just to think about why they're doing the things they're doing and why they enjoy those. Mentioned earlier, we encourage them to take the mock ACT that's coming up. And then for those of you that have sophomore students, your students hopefully already took the PSAT. And then as juniors, we'll take that again. And for those of you who are freshman parents, they'll be invited for the first time as sophomores to take the PSAT. As parents and guardians, a few things you can be doing. Obviously, it's no secret, I don't think, that the cost of college is ridiculous in the United States. We are now, private education for most colleges and universities is between $65,000 to $70,000 a year. The in-state tuition rate at the University of Washington is around $26,000 a year. So I don't need to tell anyone that the cost of education is not cheap. So as parents and guardians, beginning to think and plan long-term for how you're going to pay for this. We have, and you'll get a communication from us later this week or early next week, a really new exciting tool and partnership that we've developed with a company called SmartTrack, which for families that are looking to figure out, we think we're borderline in terms of qualifying for financial aid. Will we qualify for financial aid? How much might we qualify for? Are there ways we should be thinking about sort of repositioning some of our assets and our savings that might maximize our eligibility for financial aid. This is actually a free service that families can use to get to begin to get some guiding answers there. And so you'll get some information about that later this week or early next week. So definitely planning for the cost of college. Also, as I was mentioning earlier, we realize there is tons and tons of information that's floating around out there about the college admission process. And we really ask, for the sake of your kids, that you really recognize what is a credible resource and what is a non-credible resource. There is always that parent, and I'm sure it's none of you, but there is always that parent that had a student that went through the college admission process that knows all the answers and that is happy to serve as the expert at any social event you go to. And 90% of the time when that information gets back to us, it is completely erroneous. I joke that we work in the only field where if you had a child that went to college, you know someone that went to college, or if you applied to college, you were therefore the expert in applying to college. And I always joke, well, I took math in high school. I took BC Calculus my senior year of high school. There is no way I am qualified to teach math. That was the last time I took it. So to recognize that in many cases what goes around the rumor mill or the parent that thinks they can serve as the expert at any social event as a college admission officer because they had a parent apply to college, they have one isolated experience with that, which, again, is a valid experience, but it is not the universal template for how all students should apply to college or what their college process is going to look like. And lastly, I think as parents and guardians, what is really hard is the process is really unpredictable. We never worry that our students are going to be happy in the end. There are definitely bumps along the way. Some students have smooth processes. They get in their first choice school. All is wonderful. And other students don't. But we never worry that in the end the student isn't going to find a place where they're going to be happy. Every year is different. There are many more students applying to college. Some of you might have seen some of the articles in the media about how competitive it has become to get into the most selective colleges. Actually, it was funny. Lisa Nelson, our office, stumbled upon in our archives typewritten notes on a typewriter from the class of 1981 of the college admission outcomes and a lot of the communications about it and what needed to happen. And that year, we had 13 students apply to Pomona. 11 of them were admitted. That does not happen anymore. Pomona is now one of the most selective liberal arts colleges in the country. And so beginning to sort of realize that, A, some if you are familiar with U.S. colleges, in many cases, what we're familiar with are the U.S. colleges as they were when we applied to college and university. And things are really, really, really different. And our goal over the years is to educate families about that so you have the tools, especially when your students are juniors, to understand what that means and how to best advise your students. We also realize, too, we live in a world that is very big, not only in higher education, but we live in a world that is huge on branding and marketing, and that the names we know best, both not only in college, but everywhere, are often the names we're most drawn to and our students are most drawn to. And I always like to tell students that I think it's important to acknowledge that and recognize that. We're not bad people for being like, well, I've heard of Harvard and I've heard of Yale, so I'm drawn to that. But it's important we begin to process that it's branding and marketing, and it's not always a reflection of quality. I tell students all the time, and you know, I have an obsession with facial products. I know deep down in my heart, if I walk across the street to the Rite Aid, which is literally right across the street from where I live, and I buy the same facial products, or I buy facial products, my skin is going to look just as good or just as bad when I'm 75 years old. I know it rationally, but something in my gut tells me I walk into the store, and I turn around, I walk out, and I'm like, okay, here's Sephora, here I come. It's an emotional thing, and I know rationally it doesn't make sense, and I'm still trying to process that. But I think it can be the same thing when it comes to colleges, because we spend so much time being bombarded with information. You know, there was one year where the New York Times talked about Harvard more than it did all community colleges combined in the United States of America. So it's understandable that there are things we know and that we're therefore drawn to. But to begin to process that, your student might or might not end up at one of those schools, but they will end up at someplace great. And we are excited to, down the road, be working with them for that. So we realize we have run a little bit over, because we promised we'd be done at 8:15, so thank you. But if there are some final questions, we will stick around informally to answer those questions. And our next coffee talk, I should know the date off the top of my head, but it is in December. Tiffany has it open, and it is on course selection. So we're going to go, and that will be right around the time that course selection opens for your students for their junior year or their sophomore year. So we definitely, if you want to talk a little more in depth about that and how what type of role that plays in the college process, we encourage you to come to our next one. But thank you for being here this evening. Mm-hmm.